Is the economy strong enough for some extra government spending? From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. President Obama will propose a budget on Monday that calls for ending the sequester, that set of mandatory budget cuts that came into effect in 2013 after Democrats and Republicans couldn't trim the budget on their own. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is here live to talk about this. Sabri, what will the president propose specifically?
$75 billion in new spending, split between defense and non-defense budgets. And this is about a 7% increase. Obama will argue that we need this for national security and economic security. And we will find out exactly how he would pay for this on Monday. But generally speaking, it'll involve cutting spending in some areas and what the White House calls closing tax loopholes. Republicans will see that as raising taxes.
Does this mean a government shutdown or some kind of game of chicken over defaulting on our debt?
Republican leaders have said they do not want that. The rank-and-file Tea Party members who might push for confrontation are less powerful these days. But it's hard to see how much will come out of this. I mean, the sequester was very unpopular. A lot of people wanted to get out from under it. But, you know, the same political gridlock that made it happen in the first place is still with us.
Sabri, thank you very much. The economist who invented gross national product in the 1930s never wanted it to be used as the final scorecard on the health of the economy. How it changes over time was his emphasis, but scorecard it is. Later this morning, the government releases its gross domestic product calculation for the last quarter of 2014. It was a vigorous 5% annual rate summer to fall, but the forecasters are figuring something closer to 3.2% this time around. But with any GDP report, caveat emptor, as the Romans said. Marketplace's explainer-in-chief, Patty Hirsch, is here. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Gross domestic product. I know it was not designed to be the headline figure for the health or poor quality of an economy, but it is by default, and there's a problem with that.
There's a problem particularly with this number because this is the advance estimate, all right? Because as it says, it's an estimate and it's always adjusted, sometimes radically adjusted. And it really depends on what you're putting into the equation and everybody differs on this. The United States, for example, it changed its GDP calculation by adding in, you know, revenues from people who are producing movies, for example. In Europe, they're going to decide to put prostitution and drug dealing and other black market activities into the GDP numbers, which we certainly won't do over here. It's a real moving target. And it certainly means that you can't compare one country's GDP with another because they're so radically different in terms of their constituency.
Now, there's a development in China that we have to talk about. In recent years, the recent history of China has been defined by officials setting regional targets, telling officials what you got to do is boost your gross domestic product at all costs. It looks like one key region is moving away from that.
Yeah, Shanghai has said that it's going to ditch its official economic growth target for 2015, and it's going to be the first big city or big province in China to do this. That said, it's actually kind of following a trend, both from the bottom and from the top, because numerous smaller cities in China and smaller local governments have decided to ditch their sort of GDP targets. But also the president of China last year, Xi Jinping, said that he's quoted, "We can no longer simply use GDP growth rates to decide who the party heroes are." So Shanghai's kind of taking its lead from its subordinates and also from its superiors in a way.
And we've covered this from time to time, but just remind me, the pursuit of GDP at all costs in China has led to some freaky things. I mean, what is one thing that comes to mind?
You see incredible lopsidedness in China's growth, right? You know, you've got some regions that grow really fast and some regions that grow really slow. And in order to catch up, some regions have done some crazy things. They've built dramatic, enormous projects that become completely useless. They become these ghost towns. The fact that they actually built and had all of this construction going on and employed people to build stuff, that improved their GDP. So it looked great on paper, but in practice, it's just an absolute nightmare for them.
Marketplace's Patty Hirsch, thanks for this explainer.
Always a pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
Let's check some stocks. The 100-share index in London is down 0.3%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are down. More than a dozen brands will run their first ever Super Bowl ads on Sunday, including Skittles, Weight Watchers, and Always, maker of feminine hygiene products. That's the most newcomers to hit the extravaganza of selling since the dawn of the millennium, Gigi Duban reports.
It was pretty tense there. NBC finally sold out of Super Bowl ads 4 days before the game. In 2014, Fox sold out 2 months before kickoff. David Greiner is digital managing editor at adweek.com.
Due to some of the controversy over the past year with the NFL, there were probably some brands that have traditionally been Super Bowl advertisers that decided maybe this was a good year to not get involved.
And for rookies, that was a chance to step in. But here's the downside.
The risk is tremendous.
Derek Rucker teaches marketing at the Kellogg School of Management. He says a good ad's got to be edgy, but not offensive. But when you're talking 100 million consumers, he says it's worth it. Even at $4.5 million a pop.
That suggests that consumers are going to be willing to spend some money. Like, what slows things down in recessions? If consumers aren't willing to spend, I don't want to spend $4.5 million to talk to them right now.
Besides, Greiner says for that post-game sales boost, one good ad is all it takes. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
And how many times has a company said that personal data they're collecting will be anonymous, stripped of your identifying information? Well, turns out experts can figure out somebody's identity if they know just 4 of their anonymous credit card purchases. All researchers needed was where and when for each of 4 transactions. Researchers then superimposed this on a pile of supposedly anonymous metadata about consumers, and bingo. The work from MIT is in today's issue of the journal Science. The money quote from one researcher: privacy is an illusion. Our senior producer is Nicole Childers. Our online digital producer is Tobin Lowe. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.